There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.
Welcome to the latest edition of Wax Ecstatic. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. And once again, friends, we gather around the table. No, not the dinner table. Lord knows I've had enough to eat already this holiday season. Now we're around, is it a card table? Maybe one of those 6-foot folding tables. We gather around the binders, the boxes, the plastic pages, the top loaders, the stacks of cards as we get together here for another episode of Wax Ecstatic. And it's not quite Festivus, almost. Depends on when you're actually listening to this. I'm releasing this today, Friday, December the 18th, but perhaps you waited a few days until Festivus, in which you have plenty of grievances to air in the year of our Lord, 2020. And I'm going to have some grievances here all tied into the set that we are talking about today. It's actually part one of a 3-part dive into some early 90s Donruss sets that are very easily overlooked. And I say overlook those early 90s Donruss sets at your own peril. No, not because of any financial investment, but because these are some damn fine sets. And because they're from the junk wax era, they're very easy to collect and very affordable. Now, as I've mentioned before, we're not going to be doing all three shows consecutively. We're going to break them up with some different sets over the next few weeks. But we will be looking at 92 Donruss, in particular Series 1, but still 92 Donruss in this program. And then two shows from now, it'll be 93, and then two shows after that, it'll be 94. And it's going to be a fun look at a very fun set that even I myself have just kind of mentally relegated to the forgotten sets of the time. And for me, it's a little personal, too, on why it's been relegated to the recesses of baseball cards from the early 90s. I like a lot of sets from the early 90s, as you know. I'm one of the few people that embrace a lot of the junk wax sets. I despise quite a few, but I embrace quite a few as well. And I think one thing that made me kind of shove 1992 Donruss, as well as other sets from 1992, even though there were good sets, Donruss kind of got pushed to the back because I remember 1992. It was not really a great time. It really wasn't. And this is where we get the Festivus poll out here and talk a little bit about 90s nostalgia because, man, is it raging nowadays? Much like me at 15 years of age in 1992, hormones raging, discovering that there are different cup sizes for, you know, women's tops, shall we say, and, you know, finding the wonders of just teenage angst, lust, you name it then. Much like me and many other flannel-wearing, head-hanging, Nirvana-foot-tapping teenagers at the time, while, you know, our systems were raging. Boy, 90s nostalgia, 30 years later, is just raging full core. And why not? There's a lot of angst these days. If there was ever a time where you yearn for the quote-unquote simple times, it's now, isn't it? It's, you know, dealing for months now with the coronavirus pandemic. It's dealing for months, if not years now, the political back and forth in this nation. the economic woes for many, many people. And it's been a pretty brutal year. And as I've mentioned before, nostalgia comes in waves. I fully expect the aughts nostalgia to come fairly soon. And I've been talking about 90s nostalgia for about a year now. It's been going on for longer than a year. But people are just yearning to throw back the clock 25, 30 years ago. And again, it's totally natural. This comes in cycles, happens every 6-8 years or so. The generation that starts paying mortgages and has to feed extra mouths with children coming on board, and you're paying back those student loans still, and your career is stalling a little bit. You don't want to worry about the stuff of being 35, 40, 45 years old. Nah, you want to throw it back to those quote-unquote simpler times when you were a teenager, maybe in your early 20s. And, you know, as 90s nostalgia rages, as people are suddenly just very willing to build monuments to the Home Alone movie series. Folks, there was only one good Home Alone movie. It was the first one. like pretty much every other movie franchise, the sequels were disasters. They were all just commercial vehicles to sell baby dolls and t-shirts and breakfast cereals. That's all they were. Okay. Case in point, Austin Powers. You want some 90s nostalgia? Let's talk about that at some point in time. But you know, you've got the Home Alone series and a new Mighty Ducks movie coming out. The NHL, speaking of hockey, the reverse retro sweaters that came out over the last few weeks. Love a lot of them. But boy, they're coming right out of the 1993-ish playbook, aren't they? And it's just amazing how in marketing and in society, everyone is just clamoring to throw it back 30 years. To which I grab onto the Festivus pole and say, whoa, 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 down, down, easy. Because I also remember the early 1990s of being a pimply-faced teenager with hormones raging, having to put gobs of hair goop in my hair when I had it. In fact, that's probably what killed most of the follicles on my head, was the various Vidal Sassoon mousses and gels and hairsprays, you name it. I wasn't just killing the ozone. I was actually nuking the top of my skull. I remember having to wear the genuine sweatshirts. Remember those goofy things? Before I hung my head and listened to Nirvana and Soundgarden and Pearl Jam, it was the god-awful pop music. Vanilla Ice, Madonna, Tony, Wilson Phillips, good Lord. Boy, just, you see, now all the nightmares of the early 90s come back. Crystal Pepsi, bad fashion, bad music, bad hair jobs. And, you know, let's not forget too bad color designs with all that fashion and music and hair jobs. You know, life before the internet, too. You know, I was actually, it's so funny. Recently, I was sitting at the dinner table with my family and my son, who's going to be 11 next month. We somehow got into the conversation of old dial-up internet. And like I informed him, I said, you know, the internet didn't exist before 1991. Which really surprised him. And then I informed him, yeah, and it really wasn't commercially available to millions of Americans until, you know, 95, 96. And I said, you used to have to, you know, use your home phone line. So if you logged on to the internet, nobody could call you at home. And depending on what plan you had, you may have been paying for long distance. You know, it cost $30 or $40 a day to go on the internet. And, oh yeah, Wi-Fi wasn't a thing until, you know, about 20 years ago. And here's my 10-year-old son just wide-eyed looking at me like I had just come in from Mars. Yes, son, we used to have to use phone lines to look at our slow-moving videos.
It used to take 9 hours to download a 6-minute clip.
So everyone's clamoring for 90s nostalgia, but again, whoa, hey. Yeah, there were some good things about the 90s, a lot of good things. For me, you know, it was a coming of age decade. High school, college, it's where I found my direction in my career, in my life. The 90s were very important to me. But, you know, let's not lose sight here that it's not always a good thing to go leaping back to the 90s. Like, do you really want to open a can of Surge soda? Ugh. Oh, my God. That stuff, you could probably wash rust off of your car with that stuff, now that I think of it. So as I look back on the 90s here and have the double-sided coin of pleasant 90s memories and horrific 90s memories, I now see 90s nostalgia almost as that climax from Raiders of the Lost Ark. You know what I'm talking about, when they're having that ceremony with the Ark of the Covenant, and they open it up, and there's angels flying everywhere, and then suddenly they turn to demons, and everyone's head explodes. That's 90s nostalgia there. Oh, it was such a simpler time, and oh my God, we used to listen to Vanilla Ice. And then it took us 8 hours to watch a movie online. Ah! So, careful what you wish for with your 90s nostalgia. And again, word to the wise, as we see stories about Wayne Gretzky rookie cards, PSA 10 gem mint cards getting sold for $1.3 million at auction houses. The majority of your card set is probably not going to sell for that much. I'm going to go out on a limb saying that. But just again, buyer beware in this age where everyone seems to think that sports cards are the way to financial success. No. The only people who are making tons of money off sports cards are the private equity that owns the Topps company, for one, but also savvy sports card shops, sports card dealers, people who have a certain select collection of cards who are fortunate to have them in PSA 8, 9, or 10 status, and people who are already sitting on money, who have money to move, and who can bid these outrageous prices for those Wayne Gretzky and Mike Trout cards, all these rarities. The market's already been bifurcated over and over and over again, and it starts in the early 90s with the premium sets, the insert cards, the subsets upon subsets, the refractors, the different colors, the variations. And when grading of cards came in the late 90s, that was a major split. That was one of the big reasons why I actually stayed away from collecting new cards for a long time, was I just could not stand the grading of the whole value of cards here and assigning this ridiculously high dollar amount to certain cards. And I always saw it as a split between the haves and have-nots. And I always aligned myself with the have-nots because relatively humble upbringing. And, you know, now the haves who were able to get those cards graded, well, now they're selling them for top dollar. And, you know, on the surface, is there anything wrong with that? No, it's called capitalism. That's what our nation's been running on for centuries now. But, it's just a reminder that unless you've found yourself in that company or you've played yourself into that company, chances are those cards are not going to be worth tens of millions of dollars. And, you know, again, the people who are going to make that money are the people who have money to spend, who work in those circles, but also The people who take the less fortunate as suckers. And that's what really bothers me is, you got the Gary Vaynerchuks, who, oh, by the way, has family heavily invested in some of these sports card properties, you know, going out there and preaching the gospel of sports cards are going to be better than your 401k. No. And that's just what really bothers me is that some people are going to be taken advantage of here. So if you've been rummaging through your cards over the last few months, and that's really one of the big drivers of the sudden interest in sports car collecting is the pandemic, people rediscovering their collections or, you know, because they've had to entertain their kids, rediscovering the hobby itself. That's great for us. But just keep in mind that even though the interest is spiking, the needle does not really move on the value of too many cards. So I always go back to the simple axiom of collect what is right for you. Collect what makes you happy. And that is a key that, you know, brings it all back to, you know, what we're dealing with in 2020. We're all wanting to throw it back 30 years ago to the quote-unquote simpler times. But whatever makes you happy, whatever takes your mind off the anxiety, the stress, all the other nonsense that we're dealing with today, that's what you should be collecting. And case in point, Mark Skoback, I mentioned him in our last show when we were talking about 63 Fleer. And I got a great comment from Mark, which we'll get to in just a moment. But the interesting thing that Mark did recently was he sent me another cardboard donation, a big pile of primarily 1960s cards, all thoroughly beat up. I mean, just run through the years of life over the last 55 or so years. And even though they're thoroughly beat up, I enjoy those cardboard donations because I get to share them with my son. You know, we look at them when they come in the mail. And I've had some dupes that Mark has sent, so I pass them on to my son. And I had a little bit of free time earlier this week where, you know, I'm looking through the stack of cards and, you know, I'm putting them away. And, you know, I spent probably about an hour just kind of sorting the cards and putting them away and putting the dupes into my son's box. And it was just a fun hour, even though I may not have known all the players, even though the cards were just beat up. And even though, you know, there's certainly no college funds being paid for this, it was just fun going through just a handful of old mid to late 1960s baseball cards. So again, Mark, thanks for sending those. And it's just whatever takes your mind off the nonsense today, that's what you should collect. So don't go into the collection of cards, the rediscovery of cards, with the notion of, I'm going to get rich. No, no. Have some fun. And whether it's cards from the mid-1960s or if it's from 1992, you're feeling that 90s nostalgia kick. Whatever is fun for you, whatever is affordable for you, whatever just makes you feel good, by all means, do that. And I think 92 Donruss is a set that will make you feel all of those feelings. And we'll get to that in just a moment. Real briefly, speaking of donations, again, if you would like to make a cash donation to Wax Ecstatic, you can do so via PayPal, paypal.me/waxecstatic. And any donation is appreciated, even, you know, small dollar donations. Those go a long way on this program. So even if it's just $5 and you haven't completely shot your wad on Christmas shopping, we'll take those donations. They'll go back in one of two ways to the program. One, helping us from a technical standpoint, keep our program alive and well on audioboom.com, sending it out to the RSS feeds all over the numerous podcast networks that pick us up. And it also helps us purchase the products that we discuss on the program. And we've done a lot of buying recently. So that goes a long way too, in that it gives us the chance to open packs or secure lots of cards that we get to talk about on the program. Now, I also recently on our Twitter feed at Wax and Gumstains, I posted a little bit of excess product. You know, when it comes to single cards, the excess product that we get here, we will pass along to our friends at Commons for Kids. Well, when I was buying the packs of cards, specifically the Donruss packs that we're going to be talking about over the next several weeks, as well as some others, I realized, I went, oh man, I've got like 20 packs of cards here. And, you know, I don't necessarily want them laying around my house. I'm busy enough as it is, hand collating a lot of the sets, the top sets from roughly 75 to 86 here. And I just don't need stacks of these early 90s cards hanging around here. So we put a 90s nostalgia wax pack, or foil pack, I guess you can call it, a 90s nostalgia package together with the leftover 92, 93, 94 Donruss packs, plus 91 Topps Archives, which we'll be discussing on our next program. That was the glossy redux of the 53 Topps set. Put those up for a low price, shipping included. Had a listener pick that up, so thank you very much. I just want to give you a heads up that over the Christmas holiday, I'm probably going to go rummaging through my collection a little bit. Probably will find two or three other things that we'll put up for a low price, shipping included, just to not only drive some funds into the program, but also to help fix that 90s nostalgia itch that you're looking to scratch here. I do know somewhere in my boxes of cards here, I've got a, we'll call it a starter set of 91 Topps. I completed a 91 Topps set a while back, and for whatever reason, I started a second one. And not too long ago, I went, why the hell did I do that? You know, one is good enough for me, so I'll probably put that up there. I do have multiple hand-collated 87 Topps sets. Again, don't know why. One I'll keep for myself, one I'll give to my son, but I do believe I have a third. So again, it's nothing that's going to help you pay down the mortgage, but it is something that if you're just dying to have an 87 Topps set, you know, you'll basically just pay shipping for it because I just want it out of my house. But that money that you do give to me, in a sense, I'll eat the shipping costs because that money that you pay will go right back into the program. I did mention cardboard donations too. If you don't want to give cash, it's perfectly fine, but you've got some cards laying around and you think there are some cards that A, would be a good topic on the show, or B, you just want to give to me because you're a good guy. That's totally fine. Email me, Matt Salmon Says, that's S-E-Z, says, at gmail.com, M-A-T-T-S-A-M-M-O-N-S-E-Z at gmail.com, and let me know what you're thinking. I don't want just a box of cards showing up on my doorstep. You know, let's figure out if it makes sense to make the transaction, or perhaps I'll direct you just to send it to Commons for Kids. And we'll gladly take those donations too. Like I said, we've actually had several show topics that have started from cardboard donations. And I do want to mention too, a cheap, shameless plug here, since I am working on those hand-collated sets, I'm almost done with 77, my birth year, as well as 84, 85, and 86 Topps. 85 and 86 Topps, I'm like 20 cards away. If you happen to have some of those card sets laying around, maybe you've got a vending box that's just sitting in your closet of one of those sets, DM me at Wax and Gumstains. Let me know what you've got. And we'll work a deal out there. I'm not looking for a donation in that sense. I'm happy to pay for the cards or shipping or whatever you want to work out. But looking to lock up, especially the 84, 85, and 86, because I'm so close, but also 77 as much as I can. Because once I put those away, then I can finally go into full force of completing some of the harder sets, including 75, 76, get a start on 78, 79, and 80, and kind of moving forward from there. So that's what we're looking for, not only just a couple personal asks, but also for the show as well. And I did want to bring up, too, Mark Skoback brought up in an email that he sent me the note that the Mari Wills MVP card, which I had mentioned in a previous episode on the 1982 Topps Kmart 20th anniversary set, the 1962 National League MVP Mari Wills, who did not have a Topps card then, I said that Topps had to gin up a fake 62 card with the Wills picture for that set. And Mark brings up a point that I had totally forgotten about. The ginned up MVP card was actually produced in 1975 by Topps, as the 75 Topps set did a 25-year retrospective of the MVPs. Those are some of the harder cards I've had to find as I put that set together, other than a halfway decent George Brett card, but that's another story for another time. But the MVP subset, if you will, it was part of the base set. It's very difficult to get some of those cards, obviously, because they are, you know, it's a card that features the AL and NL MVP of those past years. And you obviously have some very notable names on those cards. So collectors have priced those up a little higher than others. But to Mark's point, when Topps was looking back at the 1962 American League and National League MVPs, which would have been respectively Mickey Mantle and Mari Wills, they had to create that Mari Wills card because Wills, as we mentioned in our program on 63 Fleer last time about, there was a contract squabble and a grudge. Wills was lingering in the minor leagues for a long time, and even though Topps signed minor league players to contracts, they didn't sign Wills. So Wills signed the contract with Fleer, which is why he is in the 63 Fleer set, but also because he was connected to that contract for the next several years, he was not free of that contract until 1967, and that's when his Topps quote-unquote rookie card, I guess you'd call it his first Topps card, came about. And by then, Wills was with the Pittsburgh Pirates, then moved on from his days with the LA Dodgers. But I wanted to thank Mark for pointing that out. I had totally forgotten about that MVP subset there. But still, to the point that I was making, there were a couple of cards in the 82 Topps Kmart 20th Anniversary MVP edition that had to be completely remade. You had the Wills card for 62 and the Fred Lynn card for 1975, where Topps basically took the mini headshot that is from the 75 rookie card. And Fred Lynn's rookie card was shared with three others. Yes, there were three Andrew Ridgelys on the Fred Lynn rookie card in 75. And they basically just took that little mini headshot and blew it up and made kind of a faux solo rookie card there. So thanks for sharing that, Mark. And again, thanks for the cardboard donations. I know you've pretty much cleaned out your house and have already updated and sent out as many of the cards as possible. But really appreciate everything that you've been sending our way. Also got a couple of kind comments here from some listeners. PK Steinberg saying, slowly catching up on podcasts. Just listen to episode 159. Now, that was one we did a few months ago about off the beaten path sets. And PK mentions, had no clue about the Swell cards. And that was smack in the middle of my collecting heyday. Thanks so much. Well, we're glad that we can make you aware of those, PK. And the Swell cards are Swell. Yeah, they're actually nice collections of post-playing days cards with some Hall of Famers. And when I say Hall of Famers, those Swell cards that came out about 30 years ago, I'm also talking about, you know, recent stars too, you know, players who played in the 1970s and early 1980s. So it's not just necessarily the stars of the 30s and 40s, but you've got a pretty big swath of players in those sets. And those are also affordable, not quite available in the number of junk wax cards that you still see these days, but certainly enough to where it's not going to cost you an arm and a leg. Also, Robert Loper sent me a nice little comment here. Said, just started listening. Takes me back to my youth. Well, thank you very much, Robert. And he continues, on episode 5, playing catch up. Wow. So All right, five down, about 170 to go. We're in the mid-170s now. So good luck, Robert. I'm sure we'll catch up again in about 2 or 3 years when you do. And it'll be interesting to listen to those old shows. One, because my mind has changed on several of the sets that we have reviewed since then. But also, the shows used to be a lot shorter. As time goes on, I tend to ramble. Well, ramble no more. Let's take a look at the 1992 Donruss set. As we go back into 90s nostalgia, this was something that we were looking into a few weeks ago. I bought those early 90s packs and asked our audience, should we do all three of these sets, 92 through 94, in one show, or should we do separate shows for the sets? And the majority rules here saying, no, we got to do separate shows. And I agree. I think it's fun to look back at these. And also, speaking of, you know, looking at the history of this program and comparing, you know, thoughts on certain sets from, say, 3 or 4 years ago to now, you're going to see some differing of opinions. And that is certainly the case of 92. I've always been a big fan of the 93 set. I didn't collect a ton of 94. I think I mentioned in the last show, I may have bought more 94 Donruss hockey cards than baseball cards. But it's going to be fun looking back at these. And it's a pleasure to look back at the 92 Donruss set, because this was a huge turning point for the base set in Donruss. But it would be too little too late for the Donruss base set. And I like to compare it to what Bowman had done just prior to the turning of the corner that Donruss did. And we did a Bowman retrospective a few months back where there was a key turning point from the rather clunky rollout of the 89 and 90 sets to a much more refined set in 91. And then come 92, a glossy revision on top of becoming the niche product of fans of rookie cards and prospect cards. And that's exactly what Bowman did. And boy, did Topps time that out right and play their cards right on recasting the die for the Bowman set. They really just hit everything perfectly to where the Bowman brand is still very, very powerful and still represents that niche very well all these years later. Donruss tried to do the same thing, but it was a little late. There were certain trends going on in the hobby that had bypassed Donruss, but also it goes without saying one reason why the sharp turnaround that Donruss had starting in 92, as impressive as it was, one of the big reasons why it flopped was because of just the absolute duds that they've released in the previous 2 years. Now, Donruss came out of the gate rather stiff in 1981, slowly improved in 82 and 83, and finally found their footing in 1984. I personally don't think that Donruss had the best sets around in the mid to late 80s. I think Fleer and Topps always outgunned them, but I don't think it's much of a stretch of the imagination to say that prior to the 1992 turnaround, Donruss's glory days were from 1984 to 1989, specifically 84 to 87. They had some really sharp cards. In fact, really 85 to 87, really sharp cards. 84 was the first year they got it right. The mid-80s, they were extremely successful. I still like 88 Donruss. I know a lot of collectors don't. I don't think it's as bad as many collectors think. It's just, it's the photography is a little dark. It suffers the same problems that other sets in 1988 did. You know, not living up to the designs and the expectations of the previous year's set. Not having an outstanding rookie class like the 87 set had. And of course, being part of the early days of the junk wax era, there were just tons and tons of these cards made. And you could still buy cases of 88 Donruss at a low price if you wish. But I still like 88 Donruss. I think 89 Donruss is very underrated. And then you had the clown car disaster of 1990, which we talked about recently on our Thanksgiving program. The 1991 set, often referred to as the Bill Cosby sweater set, I've called it the Tony set because it is very reminiscent of just pop culture in 1991. I do have some fond memories of buying 91 Donruss. It was one of the first boxes of wax packs that I bought as a collector. And I think I had the first series. It was the first year that Donruss split the set into two series. But, you know, if you open up a pack of 91 Donruss today, there's really no magic to it. There just isn't. The cards are very cold. There's just nothing that jumps out about it. And it just kind of gets pushed off to the side. So while 91 Donruss was better than the 90 set, then again, pretty much anything could be. While 91 was better than 90, it's still just kind of a set. So that's why when you look at 1992 and you compare it to the previous products and you kind of look at where the hobby was going at that time, the 92 Donruss set is really an incredible set. First of all, instead of going for the big color splashes that Donruss had, and you can even include 89 because you kind of had that rainbow trim to the set too, Donruss made it really, really simple. Small white outline border, a lot of crystal clear photography. In fact, some of the best photography Donruss had ever started appearing in the 1992 set. The colors were very limited. You had some kind of icy blue bars at the top and the bottom of the card. At the top, it says 1992 Donruss and just this very simple, almost like a Times New Roman typeface. There is no big Donruss logo. That's just it. And on the bottom, you had the player's name in these recessed silver letters on top of that blue bar, the team name, and the position that the player played. No team logo, nothing flashy or special there. And that was it. But the simplicity was a very, very welcome product following just the clashing of colors, the loudness of everything that came out in 89, 90, 91. So that was one of the first things that collectors would have seen. A muted, simple, but very classy design. But once you open up the cards, that's where you saw just this mountain slide of improvements from Donruss. First of all, just opening the cards. Instead of your standard 1991 wax packs inside a cardboard box, you had much better quality boxes. Hobby boxes were metal boxes. The packaging was the tamper-resistant foil packaging, which, of course, by 1992, pretty much everybody was going to some kind of form of that. Donruss definitely going forward with that, with the foil packaging. The first series was in this dark blue color of wrappers with a gold trim to the wrapper. I mentioned in the video that we posted, by the way, you can look at it on YouTube, Wax Ecstatic 1992 Donruss Pack Break. I mentioned that the dark blue reminds me of the Queen's Greatest Hits that were released around that same time there. Queen's Greatest Hits CD, the artwork was kind of this dark blue with gold. And it tied in with Freddie Mercury's death and also the movie Wayne's World coming out, which reintroduced Queen and Bohemian Rhapsody to a whole new generation of people. And, you know, it's kind of interesting how mentally I've kind of tied those two things together because they just came out at the same time. But you have that dark blue and gold for Series 1. Series 2 was kind of this burgundy red look with the gold. So all of a sudden, the wrappers, you know, have this first-class look to them and feel as well. Like I said, this wasn't just your cheap wax wrapping. There was actually, you know, some kind of special feeling to the product when you first opened it. And before you opened it, if you read the small print on the wrappers, you would see that Donruss had created an all-star club where you had exclusive access to Donruss products and, you know, you could get special cards and this, that, and the other. And this was a response to what Topps had done with Topps Stadium Club. And, you know, it's a reminder that when Stadium Club came around in 1991, it wasn't just a set of cards. There was an actual Stadium Club. There was a VIP membership club that you could sign up for to where you got the Members' Choice cards. You could purchase the Stadium Club set actually in a stadium. Remember that little miniature version of Rogers Center, once called Skydome, that the set came in? And it came in that stadium because that's where the All-Star Game was played in 1991. So all of a sudden, all of the bells and whistles were getting upped here in the hobby. So Donruss answered the top Stadium Club challenge with the Donruss All-Star Club offering. I don't know if anybody ever signed up for that. If you did, let me know. Share any memories you have about it with us at Wax and Gum Stains on Twitter. I'd be curious. I know in the past we've talked about joining this Topps Stadium Club, buying some of the merchandise from the Topps team store, or having Topps magazine, and we've had some listeners who have chimed in with, oh yeah, I used to get that magazine, or I signed up for Stadium Club or whatever. So if you were actually a member of the Donruss All-Star Club, I'd like to know what was that like. I'm sure the numbers weren't quite as big as some of the offerings Topps had back then, but it'd be interesting. So that's just, we're at the wrapper here. So once you open up the wrapper and you see the cards inside, you not only see that classy presentation on the front of the card, like I was talking about, but you also see it on the back. There's a lot of stuff going on the backs of 92 Donruss cards. As Donruss still stuck with the recent Major League Experience presentation, which I've never liked. It's so hard to boil down, especially an all-star veteran player's career, into just the last 5 years. But Donruss still went with that. They still had the personal information about the player, career highlights and stuff like that. But rather than just presenting that in almost a plain spreadsheet form on the back of the card, they move things around to the periphery of the card so that you could have a headshot of the player, full color headshot of the player, right on the middle of the back of the card. And this headshot kind of gradiated into the text of the career stats. And this was all presented horizontally on the set. And even though there's a lot going on, it actually still somehow works. And it's a very busy back of the card, but still it gets the job done. The only downside is, depending on the color of the player's uniform, and I'm thinking in particular like the Chicago White Sox black spring training jerseys or the Minnesota Twins dark blue spring training jerseys. If the picture, as it fades into the career stats, if it's a dark colored jersey, it tends to blend in with the stats and it makes it a little hard to read. So that was one of the few downsides of it. But that was just such a far cry from the standard, and I do mean standard, back of the card that Donruss had been putting out, essentially unchanged since 1985, tweaked a little bit since 1982, but completely overhauled in 1992. Now, the card stock was also much improved over what Donruss had been putting out in previous years. In fact, you could argue Donruss had the flimsiest of card stocks throughout their entire existence, and they finally upped their game on that with the 1992 set. Not a UV coated card stock, which was all the rage come 1992, but a glossy card stock, very thick, definitely a high grade stock where your cards were not bending, increasing as quickly as they used to. You also had to try to reduce counterfeiting, a word mark of the Donruss logo on the back. If you flex it just right under some sunlight or artificial light, you can see that. And really just an outstanding product, again, from start to finish. Now, the 92 Donruss set was the second year that Donruss split the set into two series. Oddly, though, they didn't split it evenly. I always thought that was so strange. It was, at the time, the largest set that Donruss had ever produced. They typically produced 660-card sets, but come 1992, as many sets did, they just kind of went overboard. 784 total cards. Series 1 was 396 cards. Series 2, 388. Yeah, I know, it was very strange. I never quite figured out why they did it that way. But they did. And there was another notable change in how they did the 1992 set, and that is the Donruss Diamond Kings. Now, Diamond Kings, the Perez Steel artwork, made its debut in the 1982 set and became a very popular part of the set. It was always the first 27 cards of the set. You had a Diamond King for each team, essentially like an MVP for each team for the previous year. And then card number 27 was the Diamond King checklist. Well, that changed in 1992. Those first cards were replaced by the All-Star cards. All-Star cards used to be at the back of the set. Well, now they were moved up to the front of the set. And the Diamond Kings became insert cards. And that was a sign of the thing, a sign of the times going on then, was that inserts were becoming all the rage. So at the time, the Diamond King insert was neat because it gave it a little bit of rarity, but also the Diamond Kings were glossy inserts. So when you had the glossy, when you had the better card stock, when you had the insert status, and the already incredible artwork by Perez Steel Galleries, Diamond King cards were just must-haves. And I think I still have, I'd have to go through my binders somewhere, a couple of the Diamond Kings from that year, like Frank Thomas, I want to say Cal Ripken Jr., I think was one of the other ones that I had. I had a couple of them, but they were just works of art. Quite literally, but they were great cards. And by moving them to insert status, all of a sudden there was some incredible value to them. A standard Diamond King card in, say, 1989, 1990 might be worth 50 cents or 75 cents, depending on the player. But once you gave it that slight hint of rarity, the high quality, some of the stars that were in that set, all of a sudden those cards were priced at $2, $3, $5, depending on the player. And I remember that they became quickly held on to collectibles. And they are still valuable today. If you are still collecting the 92 Donruss set, you could still get a little bang for your buck with some of those inserted Diamond King cards. Jeff Bagwell was one, too, that I had. I remember that one. What's also interesting is, and this kind of dovetails onto a separate set that Donruss was making, and maybe we'll revisit this set again. I know we did once upon a time, but Triple Play, which was designed more for younger kids, there was a different version of Diamond Kings for the Triple Play set, yet it had the same insert status, glossy, rarity, look and feel to it. So those cards, so it was kind of like a second version of Diamond King's, different set of players. There were some different values to those as well. So Donruss, even outside of the base set, going all in on the insert card craze that was starting to drive the hobby in the early 1990s. Now, other than the cards with the Diamond King series, there's not a whole lot of value inside the 1992 Donruss set. And that should not be a surprise. For one, because you're right smack dab in the junk wax era. Two, even though you do have some pretty phenomenal young players, such as Jeff Bagwell and Frank Thomas and several others, Ken Griffey Jr. at that time, there's just so many cards from that era that there's still way more supply than demand. And I actually found this laughable when I was looking around to pull some of the details from the 92 set, like card counts and stuff like that. Some website did the top 10 most valuable 1992 Donruss cards, which, hey, you know, it's easy. You can find the top 10 most valuable cards in any set, even in the junk wax era. But this site had priced some of these cards in PSA gem mint status. And I think the top valued card was the Mike Mussina rookie card, which PSA 10 is worth $20. Now, hey, $20 is nothing to sneeze at. It's $20. But that just kind of goes to show you, you know, where 1992 Donruss is in the grand scheme of things in the pricing status of the hobby. You know, if you get a 85 or rather an 84 Fleer update Kirby Puckett or Roger Clemens, PSA 10 Gem Mint. You're talking several hundred, if not thousands of dollars. Whereas the top card, which is presumably the Mike Mussina rookie card, is slightly less than that. So keep that in perspective. Like I was talking about earlier, even though 90s nostalgia is big, and even though sports card collecting interest has gone through the roof over the last year or so, still the bulk of your cards are not worth a ton of money. But that is where we, again, approach this as collect what you like, collect what is fun. And 1992 Donruss is a fun, sharp set. And I'm going to say the exact same thing about the 93 set, about the 94 set too, because they are great cards, loaded with great players, Hall of Fame players. Like I mentioned, you've got Frank Thomas, Ken Griffey Jr., Jeff Bagwell. Think of some of the established stars already. I pulled a Robin Yount card from one of the packs, a Wade Boggs All-Star card as well. I mean, there's just loads and loads and loads of star players, young stars, rookie cards, Hall of Famers as well. And as many of the Junk Wax era sets are, they are very affordable, easy to collect sets. So yeah, 784 cards, it's a lot, compared to what Donruss used to put together. But considering Topps was still putting out 792 card sets back then, it's not really out of the realm of possibility to put together. Now, prices, again, have inched up a little bit because of the 90s nostalgia, so it's going to cost you a little more today to get a factory-sealed box or a stack of packs from somewhere. It's going to cost you a few more dollars than it normally would. So, you know, shop around a little bit. You could still find some good deals. And, in fact, chances are, a set like 92 Donruss, if you're looking for packs and boxes to try to hand collate a set, then it's probably best that you go to a card show or your local card dealer, because the people on eBay and other sites are going to try to mark it up just a little bit. You're still going to find good deals. In fact, you could probably buy many boxes for $20, $25 at the local card shop or local card show. Whereas online, you're going to be paying a little more just because there is a little more interest in the product these days. But however you get your hands on the set, I think you're going to still enjoy it, as the 92 Donruss set is such an improvement, and you can argue it was the best set that Donruss had put out at that time. And as we'll discuss in future shows, they certainly upped the ante in 93 and 94 with a quality set, but it was a little too late. First of all, because everybody else by 1992 had already upgraded their sets. And for reasons I've discussed before, once Upper Deck came around, and then once you started getting the premium sets such as Stadium Club, then everybody's base set had to be improved in quality. And as we discussed recently, when talking about Leaf Studio and the Leaf set, well, the Leaf Company, which was the parent company of Donruss at this time, had invested so much research and development and time and thought into all of these other sets that the base set, as nice as Donruss was suddenly the low man on the totem pole. All of a sudden, all of the money, all of the attention, all of the promotion was going to Leaf and was going to Studio and was going to all these other premium sets that Donruss was putting out, to where even though Donruss was a very good product at this time, it just got overwhelmed by some of the other branches of the Leaf Company. And, you know, there's the old saying of divide and conquer, and sometimes that works in warfare, but in terms of the hobby warfare that was going on in the early 1990s, in the case of Donruss, it didn't work. And that's because there were just too many products. Like I said, you had Leaf, you had Leaf Studio, you had Donruss, eventually the Elite set would come out, and also, as I mentioned before, Triple Play was out, aimed towards even younger kids. You had, you know, four or five different versions of Donruss, or Donruss slash Leaf, I guess I should say. And that is on top of all the other sets that were out there, your base sets, your Stadium Clubs, your Fleer Ultras, your Pinnacles, you recall all those crazy sets that were coming out in the early to mid 90s. And I think another key too is that unlike Bowman, which was able to find its niche with rookie and prospect fans, Donruss never did. It was just carrying on the flag. You know, hey, this is, you know, the legendary Donruss set. And same thing with Fleer and Score and all the other sets, you know, other than Upper Deck. Upper Deck was its own beast at this point in time. But definitely, in the case of Donruss, even though they made marked improvements to the set in 1992 and would continue to do so for several years on, it just got overwhelmed. It just got caught up in the undertow of the crashing waves of the hobby. And there was the insert-a-palooza, I guess we can call it, the rookie card craze, the you know, base sets trying to out finesse one another while also trying to protect the integrity of all these premium sets that they're putting out. And then, as I mentioned too, once you got the grading involved into the hobby, you know, several years later, then all of a sudden, you know, properties like Donruss just got completely swallowed up, and there just wasn't that much interest in it. But again, the shortcomings of that time, well, now you can cash in with them, in not necessarily in a financial sense, but you can take advantage of it. Let's put it that way. You can take advantage of what were then shortcomings by, you know, getting some great cards now at great prices. You can put together a pretty classy set here in 92 Donruss for not that much coin. So if it makes you happy, if it makes you feel good, then by all means, plunk down a little coin, get your 92 Donruss, and spend a few hours opening up the old packs and putting together your set and reminiscing about some of the names, some of the teams, and some of the sets that came out in the early 90s that we kind of forget about almost 30 years later. I know I have. You know, when I first looked back at 92 Donruss, Juan Gonzalez was our card pull. This would have been almost 4 years ago. I remember thinking it's a good but not great set. I still think when you compare 92 Donruss to other sets that came out in 92, it's still kind of middle of the road. But on the surface, just face value, it is a great set. Classy look, nice and clean, such a huge improvement from the previous sets. It almost makes you forget about the 90 and 91 sets. And just loaded with some great players. Unfortunately, overloaded was the hobby at that time, and that's why a lot of people have since overlooked the set. But you can take advantage of it nowadays, get some good deals on the set, and perhaps bring in your own 90s nostalgia with some nice, clean, icy blue 92 Donruss, and perhaps some nice little Diamond King inserts along the way. Now, speaking of some of the players, we went through the packs that we opened, and I only opened a couple of packs in our pack break, but going through the cards, I found four players that stood out as interesting names of early 90s baseball, and we thought it'd be fun to just kind of check up on their careers and what's happened to them since. And in fact, the first card that we pulled from the packs was a rated rookie. Oh yes, the dreaded rated rookie tag. Sometimes Donruss hit the nail on the head. Often they did not. But we actually had two rated rookies in the packs that we pulled, and they actually had pretty decent careers, including Reggie Jefferson, pictured in his Cleveland Indians uniform in 1991. Now, he would be part of a major trade with the Indians in just a little bit, but first let's back it up, as he was born and raised in Tallahassee, Florida. And he was a three-sport star, lettering in football, basketball, and baseball. He just happened to live in a neighborhood where baseball was very big. He was playing with the tutelage of his father at a very young age. And what's interesting about Reggie Jefferson is he is technically a switch hitter, and that was something that he thought he should do throughout his career, but he discovered at a very early age and through the guidance of some professional coaches that he should hit exclusively left-handed. So while you look up Reggie Jefferson on, say, baseballreference.com, you'll see switch hitter. That's how he started his career, but that is not how he ended it. Now, baseballreference.com does point out that he was a switch hitter prior to the 1994 season, but it's an interesting story of how he came up that way. Normally, you would think training and growing into a switch hitting role would be beneficial, but for Reggie Jefferson, it was not. Now, he was drafted by the Cincinnati Reds in the third round of the 1986 MLB draft, and he was traded by the Reds in 1991 for Tim Costo. He went from the Reds to the Indians, so a very, very brief cup of coffee with the Reds in 91. In fact, appeared in just five games before getting moved to Cleveland. Now, he would have a couple of successful seasons for the most part, spent most of his time going back and forth between the minor leagues in 1992, but still batting .337 in his 91 plate appearances, then became more of a regular player in 1993 with 113 games played, a .249 batting average, and got to see pretty much all of the field. He was a utility guy. You could drop him into the outfield, specifically left field. He could also play first base and be a DH. One thing that he could not be, though, was a dependable hitter against lefties. And when I say a dependable hitter, I mean he was just atrocious against left-handed pitchers. In fact, a difference in his lifetime stats of nearly 100 points. I think he hit 316 against righties and like 219 against lefties. So, and that's especially odd as a switch hitter early on. You would think being a righty going up a left-handed batter would be a benefit to the batter. But that was not the case. His numbers as a right-handed hitter against a left-handed pitcher were just absolutely abysmal. And that was something that unfortunately would plague Jefferson throughout his career. Now, as I mentioned, he was part of a major trade with the Indians in December 1993, traded by the Indians along with Felix Fermin and Cash to the Seattle Mariners for Omar Vizquel, who is always coming up in the news as a potential Hall of Fame candidate. Recently coming up in the news for some not-so-Hall of Fame off-the-field antics, but we'll see how that plays out. So for Jefferson, he would play in Seattle for just 1 year, the strike-shortened 1994 season, before moving on to Boston as a free agent, signing with them just before the start of the 1995 season. And that's where Jefferson would have his most success. Again, platooning for much of the 1995 season, but becoming more of a regular player in 1996 and 1997, appeared in 122 games in 136 games in 97, actually batted .347 in the 1996 season, and he would have qualified for the third highest batting average in the league if he had not fallen short in the at-bat needed column. So that's where the problem of being a pinch hitter, a platoon player, he wasn't able to get enough at-bats despite appearing in 136 games. Let me see, 524 plate appearances. Oh, that's 1997, excuse me. 386 at-bats in 122 games in 1996. He was actually loved by a lot of Red Sox fans. He was known as the Miracle, as he was able to come up with some clutch hits at key times, and also was one of the many spark plugs in the resurgent Boston Red Sox teams of the mid to late 90s, led by Mo Vaughn and Nomar Garciaparra, but Reggie Jefferson was definitely one of those guys. Now, he was also one of those guys whose career was ruined by Jimmy Williams. He wasn't the first. He wouldn't be the last. He butted heads with Jimmy Williams early and often. And by the 1999 playoffs, when Williams, Jimmy Williams, left Reggie Jefferson off of the playoff roster, that was it. That was the end of it for Jefferson. Didn't want to return to Boston, and ended up playing 1 year in Japan with the Seibu Lions. It turned out to be a pretty valuable experience for Jefferson, and it would help him out with his post-playing career, which has been varied. He has been a coach at the minor league level with the Albuquerque Isotopes, also at the collegiate level at the University of South Florida in Tampa, and that is where he resides today. He is a player agent and a frequent visitor to the Twitter.com machine. So if you were wondering what Reggie Jefferson is up to today, you can find him on Twitter talking all things sports, kvetching about the Browns and Ravens game a few nights ago. So that's what's happened to rated rookie Reggie Jefferson. Now, what about another rated rookie, Dave Nilsson? Everybody's talking at me. Oh, no, that's a different Nilsson. No, Dave Nilsson has made himself quite famous in the land down under. The Australian native, born in 1969, raised in Australia as well, had a couple of brothers who had some chances with some Major League Baseball organizations. They didn't make it, but Nilsson definitely did in the major leagues, not only as an all-star catcher, but certainly back home ever since his playing days. Now, he was born in Brisbane, Queensland. Like I mentioned, he had a couple of brothers who were involved in some major league opportunities, but never were able to progress past the level A of minor league. He signed as an amateur free agent at the age of 17 by the Milwaukee Brewers, January 1987, as a catcher. And it's interesting, Dave Nilsson's rise to the major leagues, he would supplement seasons in the minor leagues as well as seasons in the major leagues once he got to Milwaukee. He would supplement those with winter league ball, if you will, playing for Australia. Of course, when it's winter here in America, it's summer in Australia. So it's interesting how the American and Australian baseball leagues kind of complemented each other. So while many players will play winter ball in a Dominican league, or, you know, younger players will play, you know, Arizona league, stuff like that, he would just go back home, play for a local team, and basically just played baseball year-round. He was one of the top prospects moving up through the minor leagues in the late 1980s. In fact, he was comparable to Ivan Rodriguez, future Hall of Fame catcher, as they were both moving up through the minor leagues at the same time. The Brewers were so impressed with Nilsson as a catcher that they moved longtime catcher B.J. Surhoff to third base at the time. And he was one of the youngest players to make his debut in the American League in 1992, hence the rated rookie designation by the Donruss people. Now, unfortunately, due to some injury problems in 1993 and 94, Nilsson saw some limited playing time, but what playing time he did see, it was all very positive. He has an interesting footnote in the history of the Texas Rangers, as he hit the first home run at Rangers Ballpark, which is now next door to the new ballpark for the Texas Rangers. That happened back in April of 1994. And also interesting, April 14th of 1994, Nilsson and pitcher Graham Lloyd formed the first all-Australian battery in a major league game. It's amazing. It took until 1994 before he had enough Australians in the league to actually have that. As I mentioned, he would go back and forth from America to Australia. It hurt him, however, in 1995 as he contracted Ross River Fever while playing winter ball. Ross River Fever, very similar to malaria, a mosquito-borne infection. It sidelined him for several months, so he started the 1995 season late, but still managed to impress a lot of Milwaukee Brewers brass with his play once he got healthy. It did take him a full season to get back to 100%, though, so he didn't catch as much. He was actually utilized as an outfielder or a designated hitter for much of those seasons. Now, he did begin getting back behind the plate starting in 1996 and became a steady force behind the plate for the Brewers through 1999. He was actually named to the All-Star team, replacing Mike Lieberthal as the National League catcher, and he became the first Australian to play in a Major League Baseball All-Star game and would be the only one to play until Grant Balfour did for the Rays in 2013. Now, an interesting point in his career here. So at this time, 1999, let me see, he was 33 years old, I believe. Yeah, 33 years old, coming off of an all-star season, could have just capitalized that into a big money-making venture by signing on as a free agent somewhere else. Well, he decided not to. His last game for the Brewers came in October 1999. He signed on to play for the Chunichi Dragons in Japan. Now, why would he do this? Well, he wanted to make himself eligible to play baseball for the Australian team in the 2000 Summer Olympics. The 2000 Summer Olympics were held where? In Sydney, Australia. So it was a chance for him to play for quite literally the home team, which Australia did not do extremely well in that tournament, but still able to play for his home country on home turf in a once-of-a-lifetime opportunity. Now, after that 2000 Olympic stint, he had a few offers from several teams, notably the Boston Red Sox. However, lingering knee issues pretty much put the kibosh on him ever returning to the major leagues. Now, he would become a force in managing baseball teams in Australia, starting with the Queensland Rams in 2003. And ever since then, he has been a very successful coach as well as front office personality in numerous Australian Baseball League positions. And he is currently the manager of the Brisbane Bandits and of the Australian National Baseball Team. And he is much beloved in Australia, a member of the Sport Hall of Fame there. And certainly wasn't of a cultural force of, say, like an Ichiro or somebody like that, but certainly represented Australia well and the Milwaukee Brewers for many years. The Brewers were very much an under-the-radar, forgettable team for much of the 1990s. You know, once the old guard of Yount and Molitor and those guys moved on to other things in the early 90s. For Yount, retirement, Molitor moved on to the Blue Jays and later the Twins before his playing days ended. They were just kind of a rather blah team. There was nothing special about the Brewers in the mid-1990s, but Dave Nilsson, definitely one of the few standouts there. Now, another young player who was not a rated rookie by any stretch of the imagination, but who had a very interesting career, Alonzo Powell, is featured here with the Seattle Mariners, although his time with the Mariners was very brief. In fact, by 1992, when this card was released, he wasn't even playing for the Seattle Mariners. He was moving on to the Chunichi Dragons, much like Dave Nilsson would eventually do. But for Alonzo Powell, it turned out to be a very shrewd move. Now, Alonzo Powell was born in the San Francisco area in 1964, and much to his delight was signed by the Giants as an amateur free agent in 1983. While in their minor league organization, was traded by the Giants along with George Riley to the Montreal Expos for Bill Lasky, and that is where he would linger for a little bit, get a cup of coffee in 1987, playing 14 games primarily as an outfielder, very similar to Reggie Jefferson, just a utility guy, could also play first base and be a DH when he played in the American League. But after a little bit of time with the Expos, he was traded once again to the Minnesota Twins. He was the player to be named later in a deal between the Twins and Expos for Jim Dwyer. Kind of languished in the Twins organization, granted free agency, signs as a free agent with the Mariners heading into the 1991 season, and has just 57 games of experience with the Mariners, hitting .216. One of those guys who had a lot of potential in the minor leagues, just was not able to turn it into much in the major leagues. But he was able to turn it into something in the Japanese League, quite so. Like I said, he signed on with the Chunichi Dragons in 1992, and he would become the first player in Japanese Central League history, the first foreign player, to win three straight batting titles from 1994 to 1996. He hit, respectively, in those seasons, .324, .355, and .340. So for a guy who could barely hit over .200 in the major leagues, he definitely found success in the Japanese league. He was four times the MPB Japanese Baseball Best Nine center fielder, and he was also a two-time Central League All-Star. And after several seasons with the Chunichi Dragons, he would move on to the Hanshin Tigers for the 1998 season. Again, an all-star and a batting champion too. But he would come back stateside as a coach, started working out in the minor leagues with the Chattanooga Lookouts in the early 2000s, later moving up through the Seattle Mariners farm systems with Dayton and Tacoma. and also would become an assistant hitting coach in San Diego starting in 2012, and joined the Houston Astros coaching staff after the 2015 season, won a World Series as a hitting coach in 2017, moved on to the Giants, his hometown team, for a similar position, left the Giants in 2019, and went back to Japan, where he is now a staff member of the Chunichi Dragons. Now, he also overcame prostate cancer in January of 2018 and is an advocate for prostate cancer awareness. So good to hear that. So once again, Alonzo Powell, a prime example of a common card, but definitely not a common person. Somebody who only had, how many games of major league experience here? 71 games of major league experience. You go looking through these stacks of cards, you pull this card out of the pack, and you're like, okay. But this is somebody who found a lot of success overseas, won a World Series as a coach, and overcame cancer, which is definitely a good thing. Now we go from a player who was just a cup of coffee for the Seattle Mariners to Mr. Mariner. Yes, Alvin Davis. And I love Alvin Davis, not only because he is generally well thought of and just a good person, but Alvin Davis was one of those players, if you were opening up packs in the late 80s and you got an Alvin Davis card, you just kind of felt bad for the guy because he was, for many years, the only halfway decent player for a truly atrocious Seattle Mariners team. And how Alvin Davis got to play for the Mariners and never went back to the minor leagues is in and of itself a small miracle, as is his upbringing. He was born and raised in Riverside, California, and his father passed away when Alvin was 10 years old. So he and the rest of his family helped his mother get through some very tough times in Riverside. He graduates from high school in 1978, was actually drafted by the San Francisco Giants, but decided to play college ball at Arizona State. Now, he had a unique attribute to his game. He was a left-handed batter, but also threw right-handed. Performed well enough at Arizona State to where the Oakland Athletics gave him a try, drafting him in the sixth round in 1981. But again, Davis wants to stay true. And of course, this is probably a big part to honoring the legacy of his father and helping his mother out. Says, nope, I'm going to bypass the big leagues. I'm going to finish my degree. And he got a degree in finance, which I'll explain actually helped him out later on in life. So after his senior season, which was in 1982, the Seattle Mariners come around and they draft Davis in the sixth round. Very quickly moves up through the Mariners farm system, and he starts the 1984 season in AAA. At the time, the Mariners farm club was in Salt Lake City. And he has a nice debut in Salt Lake City. He goes 2-for-3 with a walk. Looks like he's going to have a nice long season there, but fate would intervene with Alvin Davis, and in a very, very good way for Alvin Davis. Not necessarily, however, for the walrus, Ken Phelps. Opening day 1984 with the Mariners, Phelps suffers a hand injury, so the Mariners need to call up Davis from AAA. And he does so well in his stint in Seattle. And again, the bar was kind of set low. The Mariners were not a very good organization on or off the field in 1984. But as Phelps starts mending, the Mariners realize, well, we've got a good thing here in Davis. And after that call-up, Davis never again played in the minor leagues, to which I say, I hope he was just renting an apartment in Salt Lake City because he really didn't get a chance to use it all that much. He would play for 9 seasons with the Mariners and had a career batting average with the Mariners of .290. And was a all-star in 1984, was also the Rookie of the Year for the American League in 1984, and really just had an outstanding stretch of seasons there. That Rookie of the Year season, by the way, 1984, appeared in 152 games, batted .284, had 27 home runs, 116 RBI. Arguably his best season. You could say that 87 was a little better. Batting average was 10 points higher. had more RBI, a couple more home runs, or not more RBI, a couple more home runs, less RBI, had 100 RBI still compared to 116. Not all that shabby. And was a guy that you could have mostly at first base, but you could also DH him as well. Very popular personality in the locker room. Was a guy that very quickly became a fan favorite. And as I mentioned, over 9 or 8 years with the Seattle Mariners, was able to hit 280 over that stretch. He also holds the Mariners' record for most consecutive games reaching base to start a career with 47, and he became a very dependable veteran player as some up-and-coming Mariners players, including Edgar Martinez, also Ken Griffey Jr., he would become a mentor to those two youngsters as the team was turning things around. He, in fact, mentioned that when the Mariners, for the first time, were above 500 late in a season, had a winning record in 1991, that it was a tear-inducing moment in the Mariner locker room, which is saying an awful lot about how bad the Mariners were at the time. But for somebody who had played on some pretty bad teams, and he was almost always the only decent player, you know, it was a big moment for him too, and for this young team as they were learning how to win. So once they won their 82nd game in the 1991 season and would for the first time secure a winning season in franchise history. Remember, the Mariners were 15 years old at that time. That was one of his highlights in his career. Now, another highlight, and I need to back up here, going back to 1984, I forgot to mention that in his first game, he hit his first major league home run. Now, this was not his first at-bat. It was just his first game. In fact, his first at-bat, he struck out. And the Mariners were hosting the Boston Red Sox. Dennis Eckersley, Hall of Famer, on the mound for the Red Sox, blows the heat right past him. And he goes back to the dugout. He's like, okay, I got that. I figured it out. He gets some scouting reports from some of his teammates, goes back up in his second at bat, and hits a home run against Eck. So quite the way to introduce yourself to the major leagues if you're Alvin Davis. Now, what happened to Alvin Davis after his time with the Seattle Mariners? Well, as I mentioned, they started having some up-and-coming young players come up through the system, notably Martinez and Griffey and several others. So for an aging first baseman, after the 1991 season, he was 31 years old. He became a free agent, and the Mariners let him walk as he joined the California Angels just for one season. Really struggled with the Angels, one of many struggling players. Whitey Herzog is the GM of the Angels at the time. Did not work out real well for him, as Davis was a flop as a free agent signee, played in only 40 games, mostly a platoon player, hit just 250, and was released midway through the season. Now, he would complete the 1992 baseball season in Japan. Boy, we got a pretty common theme here with a lot of our players this week, don't we? The Osaka Kintetsu Buffaloes, that's where he completed the 1992 season, appearing in 40 games as well in Japan with 5 home runs and 12 RBI. A nice way to kind of put a little bow tie on his career. Now, that was as a player. As a coach afterwards, he would find some success, first as a roving minor league instructor with the Seattle Mariners, but also very active in his hometown. He still resides in Riverside, California, with his wife and 3 children, and his mother, who I believe just celebrated her 100th birthday, which is quite the accomplishment to begin with, but also the fact that having to reach 100 while going through this coronavirus pandemic in California is quite a feat in and of itself. So he's been very close to his mother, obviously, ever since his father passed away 50 years ago, and certainly great to see her get to that milestone this year. Now, I mentioned that he stayed at school at Arizona State to complete his finance degree, and it worked out real well, as he has worked as a volunteer for his church, the Cornerstone Fellowship Bible Church. And for much of the last 8 or 9 years, he has overseen the church finances and has served as a member of the church's elder board. And he has also continued coaching at the amateur levels. He has previously coached at Martin Luther King High School. He was in that position for 10 years before getting involved in the Seattle Mariners organization. So there you go, Mr. Mariner, Alvin Davis. And like I said, you know, anytime you picked up any cards of his in the late 80s or the early 90s, because things were just so bad with the, you know, the Mariners on and off the field, you felt bad for him. It's just like, oh, really? Come on now. You know, this poor guy, is he ever going to, you know, play for a legitimate team? Is he ever going to play for a contender? Well, he never did play for a contender, but he certainly left his fingerprints all over the Seattle Mariners organization for many, many years. So a great way to wrap up the program as we talk about not only Mr. Mariner, but also, you know, the not so common life of Alonzo Powell and some rated rookies who, did they turn out to be superstars? No, but they certainly had some pretty lengthy, noteworthy careers, that, of course, in Dave Nelson and Reggie Jefferson. Now, did 1992 Donruss turn out to be a superstar of a set? No. Like I said, it gets lumped into the wax, junk wax era of cards, unfortunately, but it is still a very sharp set, and because it is part of the junk wax era, there's still plenty of it out there. So even though the prices have crept up just a little bit in the heat and throes of a 90s nostalgia right now, you can still purchase some for a pretty low price. You can probably still find some factory sets out there at decent prices, but like I said, if you want to hand collate them, it won't cost you an arm and a leg to do so. So get your hands on some 92 Donruss, scratch that 90s nostalgia itch that you have while looking at a base set that Donruss put out that was outstanding, but unfortunately for Donruss, came a little too late in the game. They were starting to get bypassed by a lot of the competition. They got swallowed up by even some of Leaf's own other sets. And even though 92 Donruss was left in the ashes of the junk wax era, the Phoenix rising from the ashes consists of a very, very nice set that's certainly worth your time to take a second look at, perhaps reinvest in. And you're not going to sell it. You're not going to make a profit off of it. There's not going to be much money coming from it. But if you're looking for something fun to do, especially just wasting away the last few weeks of this tumultuous year, and, you know, looking to just find something that'll, you know, put a smile on your face and pass some free time during the holidays here, maybe with your kids or even on your own. You're just looking to kill some time. 92 Donruss is definitely a good set worthy of your time to try to put together. And like I said, take a second look at it. I think you will enjoy looking back at it, even if looking back at 1992 and your pimply faced self is not so joyous. Now, we're really going to throw it back in kind of a back to the future way, as our next program, which will be released on Friday, January 1st, 2021, we're going to go back to 1991, but through 1991, we're going to go back to 1953. It's interesting how the throwback movement really started right around this time. And there were hints of going back in time through sets like the Topps big sets of the late 1980s. But Topps went all in on the throwback, turn back the clock movement that was happening in the early 1990s. And in 1991, they did so by honoring arguably the best set that Topps has ever put out, the 1953 Topps set. And we're going to look at the 1991 Topps Archives look back at 1953, not just a glossy re-release of that legendary set, but also the inclusion of what could have been cards of players that did not actually have a card in the 1953 set. We're going to talk about that and kind of the legacy of that 91 Topps Archives has left 30 years later. So again, we will discuss that January 1st as we ring in the new, throw out the old, and take a look back at a set that did the exact same thing, a new look at an old classic, 91 Topps Archives. Look at the 1953 Topps set. Again, if you would like to make a cash donation to Wax Ecstatic to help keep this program going, keep our archives free for you to listen to, you can do so at paypal.me/waxecstatic, or you can make a cardboard donation. Again, please email me first with your thoughts about that, mattsalmonsays@gmail.com. And until then, rate and review our podcast. Positive reviews greatly appreciated. Negative reviews will be mocked. And share our Twitter timeline at Wax and Gum Stains with your friends. Have a Merry Christmas, a happy holiday season, and we will welcome in with open arms a year not called 2020. Here's hoping that 2021 is far better than this absolute debacle of a dumpster fire that has been 2020. And until you get that vaccine shot in your arm, wear your mask, social distance, and wash your hands frequently. Let's get through the final stages of this pandemic healthy as possible. I'm your host, Matt Salmon. We will see you in 2021 with the next edition of Wax Ecstatic.
There are everyday actions to help prevent the spread of respiratory diseases. Wash your hands. Avoid close contact with people who are sick. Avoid touching your eyes, nose, and mouth. Stay home when you are sick. Cover your cough or sneeze. Clean and disinfect frequently touched objects with household cleaning spray. For more information, visit cdc.gov/COVID-19.
Furnished by the National Association of Broadcasters and this podcast.